Deutsche Welle Spotlight on Europe.
Many thanks for joining us here on Spotlight on Europe. It's always a pleasure to have you on board as we take a look at major events here in Europe, but from an African perspective. My name is Jane Nyinge, and in today's program, Belgium braces itself for the return of jihadists from the Middle East, and this is causing anxiety among residents.
How strong is their influence? Well, basically, we'll only know when the next attack happens, I'm afraid.
And to tip or not to tip? That is the question here in Germany. Also in the program, we head to Ireland, where the government has announced a referendum to revoke the country's restrictive abortion laws. Well, all that and more coming up shortly. We start off in Israel, and the government has reacted angrily to a bill passed by both houses of parliament in Poland, which aims to punish anyone who accuses the country of complicity in the crimes of Nazi Germany. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu accused Warsaw of trying to rewrite history. The Israeli government is concerned that the law might lead to a distortion of historical truth, in particular regarding the role some Poles played in crimes committed against Jews. Polish authorities had refused to give in to Israeli demands to change the bill, which is likely to be signed into law by Poland's president within the next few weeks. From Warsaw, Julian Barna files this report.
Last week, groups of Holocaust survivors converged on the former Nazi death camp of Auschwitz to join commemorations of the International Holocaust Remembrance Day. But as the last Jewish survivors prayed on the site, on the eve of the ceremonies, the lower house of the Polish parliament passed a bill which the Israeli government describes as very controversial. Warsaw says it is meant to penalize those who suggest that Polish people were co-responsible for what happened during the Holocaust. Yet in Israel, fears are expressed that the wording of the law might lead to a distortion of truth and stifle research on crimes committed against Jews by Poles during World War II. Israeli ambassador to Poland, Anna Azari, thus explained her government's concerns in an interview for the independent station TVN.
Israel is on the same page with Poland when it comes to the fact that the camps were built by Nazi Germany. But the bill approaches the matter very broadly. In Israel, it's thought that this could make it possible to bring journalists to account, and even Holocaust survivors who give testimony about their own experiences.
One person who believes he might be in trouble under the new legislation is Polish Jewish historian Jan Gross, who lives in the US. His book about a massacre of Jews in the village of Jedwabne, committed by their Polish neighbors, has opened the eyes of many in Poland to the darker side of life under the Nazi occupation. But it has also outraged many traditional Poles who are convinced that their compatriots were only the victims of Nazi Germany. Jan Gross quotes many well-documented examples that this was not always the case. For instance, concerning Polish policemen who served under German orders.
Policemen implicated in crimes against the Jews, in their actions against the Jewish population, one can notice a large element of freedom and independence from superior German authority. In the cases at hand, there was not a single instance in which apprehended Jews were escorted back to a ghetto or to a police station, which would also mean death for them. They are usually killed right away or in a neighboring forest, and local peasants are ordered to bury the corpses. The direct motive to commit the majority of murders and denunciations of Jews hiding in the countryside was the desire to plunder them.
Polish authorities declare that the intention of the bill is only to prevent what they describe as a growing number of defamatory articles in world media, at a time when the numbers of those who actually lived through the war are dwindling. Mateusz Szpytna is the deputy head of the Institute of National Remembrance in Warsaw.
It's out of the question that anyone would be prosecuted for telling the truth about what actually happened. In the case of the Jedwabne massacre, the results of an investigation have been published. They prove that Poles took part in a crime committed against the Jewish population, inspired by the Germans. There is no doubt about it.
One of the most disturbing Polish films of the past decade is Aftermath. It tells the story of a young man who discovers dark secrets about his home village, where Jews were murdered by Poles during the war. There are those who wonder if artists would now be free to make such movies under the new law. Maciej Bernat-Reszczyński is the author of a book about Polish policemen who served under the Nazis. He says he finds the present government's approach to history dubious because it turns a blind eye to the rise of right-wing extremism in Poland.
They are using history to justify current political actions and trends. Frankly, I think these are quite dark times for people who want to understand what has gone on. Particularly difficult aspect of German rule was dealing with the Jewish population. At the same time, this wasn't a Quisling type of situation. This wasn't Vichy kind of situation. That put many Poles under pressure, which they didn't bear very well. There was heroism, there was corruption. I don't think this is something that we can establish in percentage terms.
The controversy over the new anti-defamation law has seriously damaged what used to be described as Warsaw's special relationship with Tel Aviv, cultivated over the past three decades. One former Polish diplomat said she was appalled by the lack of empathy toward Israeli sensitivities. Observers note that focusing on history and trying to protect Poland's image abroad at all cost, the present government keeps alienating its allies, having already jeopardized its ties with its neighbors and now Israel. Julian Berner, DW, Warsaw.
With so-called Islamic State being pushed out of territory in Syria and Iraq, many of its fighters are looking for somewhere else to run. For some, it will be home to Europe. From Brussels, Terry Schutz reports on the challenges that poses to the countries of origin.
Belgium saw an estimated 500 citizens leave for Islamist battlefields, the most per capita in Europe. Many, if not most of those, have died. Others will stay fighting until they do. Iraqi authorities are holding some, but more than 100 have returned to Belgium, making many communities nervous. Earlier returnees trying to reintegrate in society are aware of the stigma and reluctant to be identified. Antwerp City Councillor Hisham Elmzer knows some of them personally and asked them to share their stories with me. Nobody was willing to speak.
Many of them came back with a huge feeling of shame. And they don't want to show that or to show their name or to be on TV to say, okay, I went there and I was a fool and I came back.
There are some exceptions. Charleroi native Laura Pessoni was all over TV in 2016, publicizing her book about being an Islamic State militant's bride in Syria. She'd gone there with a new husband and her four-year-old son. Pessoni said she'd had no idea what she was getting into and decided to escape when her little boy showed her how he'd been taught to behead a teddy bear. Now Pessoni occasionally visits schools as part of the Belgian government's anti-radicalization efforts, but she declined our multiple requests for an interview. Some returnees have other motives for staying in the shadows. Those are the ones that worry Hisham Elmzer and Antwerp's Muslim community.
They don't want us to see that they are back, and they, to be honest, they don't show any feeling of shame. They are more frustrated about the fact that IS and their caliphate is losing, but they are here.
That describes returnee Michael Delafortri precisely. In 2013, he spent 2 months with the so-called Islamic State in Syria, but came back to Belgium to see his wife, he said. He was arrested and tried, but set free after receiving a suspended sentence. Delafortri also wrote a book and gave many interviews, like this one on Euronews, praising IS and life in the so-called caliphate.
I did something wrong in the first place. The only thing I maybe can blame myself is that I came back because I had a life over there.
We couldn't speak to Delafortri as he's in prison on charges unrelated to his time in Syria. But that willingness to be interviewed has dried up. Sources tell me returnees and their families are urged to keep a low profile by Belgian authorities, and even more ominously, by others watching from the war zone. The brother of a Belgian fighter gave a television interview a couple of years ago with his identity disguised. Islamic State supporters found him anyway and beat him badly as a warning to others to keep quiet. Local communities are having to figure out how to deal with people who return. Vilvoorde, just north of Brussels, is far ahead of most. Many youths left this suburb to join IS. Mayor Hans Bonte has known most of them all their lives and takes a personal interest in their futures. He visits those sentenced to prison to make sure they understand their choices. Bonte warns them that after their release, they will be under constant scrutiny. But that's not all, he tells them.
The second thing I said is, when you are free, you are a free man. You have had your punishment. You have the right, and we will help you to give you all the opportunities to reintegrate in a positive way.
Bonte gives us an example of how his city supported one returnee committed to being a law-abiding citizen, finding him a job and an apartment by being completely transparent about the situation.
And we informed the employer who was ready to give him a chance after all the information that we have got was transferred to that employer. The same thing on the housing side.
That man is still a success story 2 years later. But there are more IS followers being groomed. Peter Van Ostien, one of the best-known researchers of the Belgian jihad movement, says he sees no decrease in pro-jihad language on social media by those who are radicalizing and recruiting.
How strong is their influence? Well, basically, we'll only know when the next attack happens, I'm afraid.
However, the Belgian government appears a bit more optimistic than Van Ostien. It has reduced the national terror threat level, meaning an attack is no longer considered probable, but rather unlikely. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
Well, if you've just joined us, this is Spotlight on Europe coming to you from Bonn, Germany. And yes, you can keep on talking to us on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Now to the Czech Republic, and pro-Russian President Miloš Zeman has won a second five-year term in office. Zeman beat a pro-EU political newcomer who fought his campaign on preserving liberal values and reaffirming the Czech Republic's place in Europe. Rob Cambrun with more from Prague.
Two lines of ecstatic supporters form a victory alley for the elderly, ailing, but still politically potent Miloš Zeman, re-elected by a margin of 152,000 votes for a second five-year term. This, said the 73-year-old president, would be my last victory, and he made a promise to be humbler and less arrogant in his next 5 years. However, almost immediately he launched an attack on a traditional target, the media, saying that he'd come to the conclusion that some journalists and politicians were of significantly lower intelligence than ordinary people. Flanked by several beaming politicians, including Tomio Okamura, leader of the far-right Islamophobic SPD party, he told journalists he would spend the next 5 years supporting what he called active citizenship, encouraging direct democracy wherever possible. That was music to Mr. Okamura's ears. He's campaigning for a Brexit-style referendum on leaving the EU. Mr. Zeman supports the referendum idea, though he said he would campaign for the Czechs to stay in. Across town, the mood at Drahoš headquarters was celebratory rather than funereal. There was prolonged applause when the liberal pro-European challenger promised that he and his team would carry on, though we're still not quite sure what he means. Several of Mr. Drahoš's rivals had thrown their weight behind him for the second round runoff, though in the end even their combined support wasn't enough. One of those candidates was Dr. Marek Hilsche.
There is no great winner and loser. It seems that the power was half and half, which shows something similar as in Britain in Brexit. But for me, Mr. Zeman doesn't represent the future for the Czech Republic. I think he's the man of the past. We have to redefine and define our relationship to the European integration. And I think Mr. Zeman is not a man who has the power, mental and physical power, to be somebody who can lead this nation toward the future.
This election was presented by the media, especially the international media, as a battle of ideas, a clash between authoritarianism and liberalism, between populism and elitism, between East and West. Michal Jantowski, former Czech ambassador to London and a close colleague of the late ex-president Václav Havel, is definitely in the latter camp, but he's not downhearted.
Well, I voted for the losing candidate, so I'm not exactly thrilled, but it was a very close contest, and I think the chances are that the coalition that supported the pro-Western, pro-democratic, pro-future candidate will stay together and will eventually prevail. That's my feeling, and that's what I am here to support.
And there is at least a sense here that this election has not quite settled things, first and foremost because of the president's health. His doctors insist all that ails him is type 2 diabetes and related neuropathy in his big toe, which prevents him from walking unaided. But Miloš Zeman seems exhausted by his first 5 years in office, and some recent TV appearances have bred much speculation that there may be something much more serious wrong with him. The question on everyone's lips here is, okay, he's won a narrow victory, but can he serve out a full 5-year term? Rob Cameron, DW, Prague.
Ireland will hold a referendum on abortion at the end of May. Voters will decide whether to repeal the country's restrictive abortion laws. DW's Keith Walker spoke to Gavan Riley, a political correspondent for Ireland's TV3, and started by asking him just how restrictive Ireland's current abortion laws are at the moment.
Well, the current laws are largely determined based on a constitutional amendment that was passed by a referendum in 1983. And in effect, at the time, that constitutional referendum was intended to ban abortion under all circumstances entirely, that it wasn't meant to allow it in any circumstances at all. Now, a little under 10 years later, there was a finding from the Supreme Court that there is access to abortion in Ireland, but only in the very narrow circumstances where it's necessary to save the life of the mother. But effectively, that is the only circumstance in which an abortion can be obtained in Ireland. And other than that, the result of the constitutional referendum 35 years ago is that it's not permitted under any other means at all.
And why the change now?
Well, effectively, it's been something that has been back on the political agenda for a couple of years, and it was somewhat hardened by a very tragic case back in 2012, the case of Savita Halappanavar, who died in Galway while she was having a miscarriage. And there was some commentary at the time that perhaps the doctors might have been able to intervene earlier and to save her life, but for the fact that they weren't able to intervene because her fetus still had a heartbeat and therefore was protected under Irish law, so an abortion couldn't be carried out. So that seemed to harden a lot of opinion about it, that there was some political clamour at the time for something to be done or for the Irish law to be changed. The government at the time said it had no mandate to do so, but the most recent government, elected in 2016, campaigned on the basis of setting up a citizens' assembly, which would look at changes in the law. It recommended that the constitutional impediments be removed. That has since gone through the political process, and now the government has made a formal decision to go through with a referendum.
When are they going to decide the wording on the ballot?
They haven't nailed down the precise wording yet, but it does seem as if really the wording is just a matter of routine, that it's just a case of getting the I's dotted and the T's crossed. Effectively, what the wording will be to remove the current restriction in its entirety and put in its place only one sentence which would authorise the Parliament to pass whatever laws it sees fit in this particular area. So really, although there is a little bit of legal technicality to be worked out over the wording, the ultimate function will be that voters will be asked to remove the constitutional restriction restrictions on abortion and to leave it into the hands of the Irish Parliament to decide the law for itself.
So they're just going to vote to get rid of what's already there, and they're not going to have a say in exactly what the new wording is going to be.
Yeah, that's right. And that's going to be something which is going to be quite contentious over the course of the referendum, because there are some people within Irish society who would agree that the current restrictions, although they might see them as being too restrictive, that they would still like to have some say in what the new regime will be. And that isn't something that's going to be catered for in this referendum, that effectively they're going to be asked to give the Parliament a free rein to pass whatever laws they see fit. Now, the Citizens' Assembly that I mentioned earlier, which has been looking at this, did recommend that the law be changed so that abortion will be allowed in cases of fatal fetal abnormality, in other words, where the pregnancy will not survive outside of the womb, in cases where it's necessary to safeguard a woman's health, but also quite significantly, they also recommended that it be available effectively on demand up to the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. And that is something which is attracting a lot of attention, because it's a sort of proposal which hadn't really been on the Irish political radar before it was made. And there is some anxiety that if people were to vote yes in this referendum, that it would lead the Parliament then to pass a more liberal law than they might be more comfortable with.
So 12 weeks would bring it into line with many other European countries, including Germany, which also has a 12-week limit. Spain has 14 weeks, Sweden 18 weeks, and recently the United States, well, they're one of a handful of countries that allows abortion on demand past 20 weeks. Now, that 12 weeks for Ireland, that hasn't been set in stone yet for the referendum, has it?
No, it hasn't been set in stone, and that's because ultimately it will be up to the Parliament to decide whether that was something that it wanted to pursue. And of course, in Ireland, we have the doubly unusual situation, whereas not only would the voters not get a say in what the new system would be, but in fact, because it's currently run by a minority government that doesn't command a majority in the Irish Parliament, that even the government itself can't say for certain what the new law might be, because somebody else might put a proposal on the table which could garner the support it needs to get through both houses of the Parliament, and the government might not necessarily have any say on the matter. So the government finds itself in a slightly awkward position where it can't really promise what the new regime would be, which is what makes the referendum something of a Pandora's box, because effectively the electorate are being asked to hand over any control they currently have in the regime and to give it entirely into the hands of a parliament with no one knows what the true outcome would be.
So once the parliament passes a law that they see fit, will there be a second referendum for the people to say whether they see it's fit?
No, there wouldn't. And that's what will make this a quite a difficult sell for some people, because if the people vote yes in this referendum and they remove any constitutional control on what abortion would be, then Parliament would basically be the supreme body that would decide what that rule would be. And that means that there are quite a number of people who might oppose the idea of this having any constitutional control at all. They might like the idea of taking it out of the constitution and leaving it in the hands of lawmakers, but they might be concerned about the proposed 12 weeks regime because that might be more liberal than they'd like. And that leaves them with something of a dilemma, because they might think that the current law is too restrictive, but they might vote against changing it because they might not like how liberal the other effect will be. And that will mean that really, although the opinion polls currently give the proposal quite a fair backing among the Irish electorate, that really with 4 months left for polling, it really is anybody's game.
That was Gavan O'Reilly, a political correspondent for Ireland's TV3, speaking to DW's Keith Walker. Now, learning the rules and cultural nuances of a foreign country can be a very long and complicated process. You stand, you fall, you walk in and out of step with those around you, gradually weaving a home among them. But sometimes all you can do is scratch your head, as we hear from Tamsin Walker in this postcard from Berlin.
The first time I realised just how alien the rules of Germany's tipping culture are to me was at the end of a less than glorious camping trip. When presented with the bill for my plot, I was so glad to be leaving that I handed over the money with an apparently hasty Danke. Money. Had I waited a moment longer, I'd have been given €8 in change. As it was, I later found out, the act of saying thank you at the moment I did meant there was no change. At least not for me. Lesson learnt. Two, in fact, as I've not pitched a tent since. I have, though, periodically wondered about the who, when and where of tipping in this country. To make things clear before I go any further, I'm not a gratuities grump. Far from it. I just think it helps to know the rules. And both pre- and post-camping, I'd been led to believe there was only really one. Unofficially enshrined, it dictates Trinkgeld, or drink money, as tips have tellingly been known for centuries in Germany, should be around 10% of the bill and given to taxi drivers, hairdressers, waiters and waitresses.
So, dann haben wir einmal Rechnung. 15, 10, dann, ja, dann 17.
Dankeschön. Vielen Dank.
Wiedersehen. So.
But the increasing emergence of tips jars on coffee house and even shop counters, coupled with a recent conversation in which a waitress told me she routinely leaves a little bit extra for the butcher and the baker, has brought the when, where and who of it bubbling to the surface.
Zahlen haben 12,30 €.
12,30 €, okay, dann. Where better to start my quest for clarity than in a taxi?
So runde ich, würde ich meistens aufrunden.
Es ist ein bisschen mehr als 10%.
The driver confirmed with inimitably brusque Berlin charm that most locals do give a bit, and most Italians don't bother. Strike one for my tipping wisdom. But he then went on to tell me how he keeps the wheels of generosity turning by sweetening the pot for electricians, carpenters, plumbers, and his postman. So strike that, strike one. I know nothing. More than nothing, I established as my onward search delivered me through the doors of a florist, a sandwich bar, and a shop selling olive oil and vinegar, armed with a question I was sure would see me laughed back onto the street. How wrong I was. They all, though some more often than others, receive tips.
Meistens sagen die ja dann zum Beispiel, okay, hier für die Jungs, sie mir jetzt 30 € Trinkgeld, die mal 20, ne, dann wird in der Kaffeekasse.
It doesn't stop there. I met a garage owner who told me his clients routinely slip him a crisp note or two. And I heard similar stories from a parcel delivery man and a physiotherapist. Exactly where that leaves me, apart from feeling like the biggest Scrooge in town, I'm not sure. But the more I think about the conversations, the more I realize everyone's as muddled as me. There's something Dr. Seuss-esque about the waitress who tips the baker, who doesn't tip the plumber, who tips the taxi driver, who doesn't tip the physiotherapist, who tips the hairdresser, who doesn't tip the postman. And so it goes on. Everyone's just making it up as they go along. As a rule, I like that approach. It's open to interpretation, rather like the word danke.
Money. Get away.
Well, to tip or not to tip, that's your own decision. That's where we end today's show. Don't forget, if you missed any bit of it or you want to listen again, you can visit our website dw.com or our Facebook page DW Africa. On behalf of the entire team here in Bonn, Germany, my name is Jen Nyinge. Thanks so much for your time.